Welcome to Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria, with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
A very warm welcome to our Care in Action podcast. Today we are producing another online podcast because I have a very special guest, my highly appreciated colleague, the CEO of Care USA, Michelle Nunn. A warm welcome to Care Austria's podcast, Michelle.
Oh, I'm so glad to be with you.
So are we. And we dive right into the topic. This podcast is produced at the occasion of the release of the 10th edition of our Forgotten Crisis report. Each year, at the beginning of the year, CARE globally, one can say, presents a very highly appreciated report, the Forgotten Crisis report. And this is about 10 most underrated humanitarian crises that happen in a world so-called forgotten, which is a bit sad, isn't it, to talk about forgotten crises. What do you think, Michelle?
It is. It is at the heart, in some ways, of what I think CARE is about, because I think we are always and forever trying to be present in the places of the greatest need. And those places of greatest need are always, struggle to get the kind of attention that the world should be paying to those that are suffering. And so I think, you know, there's literally our way of talking about our work is CARE is always there, and we are there whether there is a spotlight on the crisis, on the suffering, on the challenges, or whether there is not. But I think the importance of literally saying that we need to attend to these places, that every life is equal, and that we need to stand with people who are suffering, and sometimes invisibly so, to the world.
Absolutely. And both of us, we have led our national organizations for many years by now, and you have led CARE through many challenging moments in humanitarian aid. So did you have any personal experience that drew you to this field? Can you share it with us? How did it come that you're working in the humanitarian field so much?
Yeah, I think I have always had a sense that there was a moral imperative for us to care, and to also turn that care into action. And so I started my career closer to home and seeing the immediate needs around, for instance, in my case, Atlanta, Georgia. But always I had the opportunity, I think, to both travel and to also have a sense that in an age in which we have really the capacity to ensure, for instance, that no child dies of hunger, that we can ensure that children are vaccinated against terrible diseases and they should not be dying from these diseases, that we have this call to action around that kind of work. And again, I think the idea that our neighbor in the age in which we live is not just the one who is next door, but our neighbor, our global neighbors. When we have the technology, when we have the media, when we have the resources to reach them, that we have to be able to act upon that. And I think any of us who have encountered the opportunity of being in service to make a difference, and then to see that translated at a global level, I think feel the power of that. And I think that's what's kept me at CARE, and it's what's inspired me to this work.
That's really great. And I also had a sparking moment when my interest for humanitarian work and fighting poverty in general was born, one can say. I had the privilege to study in Brazil, and I was the guest of a very wealthy family. And the first time ever in my life, I saw that the staff of the family, they were not allowed to take home the leftovers of the food. And then I traveled the whole country. Brazil is like a continent. And I saw the favelas 40 years ago. And I thought, this sort of inequality, which is somehow nourishing a system that makes it very comfortable for few, is not fair. And I was always thinking about the lost potential and capacities that those people born in not only favelas in Brazil, globally living in poverty, what is the world losing on knowledge, on wisdom, because these people don't get a chance. And this was my sparking moment more than 40 years ago in the meantime, starting in Brazil. And I think it is for any profession, it is good to have a sparking moment where you see, this is my intrinsic motivation then, because this keeps us going through the decades, right?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, you could extrapolate that story to the forgotten crisis, because it is sometimes true that we literally don't see people. We don't see their needs. We don't see their suffering. And sometimes they're quite close to us and sometimes they're farther away. But we should make sure that we have visibility. I also, when I was in my early 20s, had the chance to travel on something called Semester at Sea, and had the chance to go to places like India and to see when you confront that deep extreme poverty, and yet you have the sense of our collective global capacity to remediate that. I think you can't help, you can't turn away.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And nowadays we have the technological structure that people could be visible. And it is very important from our point of view to highlight that this Forgotten Crisis report, it's not a critique towards the media. This is really key, because no media channel in the world, be it digital or be it analog, can focus exclusively and on all the many places that are in crisis. So we see us in partnership with the media globally. So this is not a critique, but a criticism. But on the other hand, Michelle mentioned it, it is really key that crisis is visible, because if you can't see it, then it's under your personal radar. And there is a clear connection, at least in Europe, this is really well researched, that underfunding has directly to do with visibility. Is it similar in the US market?
100%. And so I think it is critical that we, I think, have collective a sense of responsibility, because the media also reflects back where they think that there is consumer and citizen interest. And mm-hmm. So I think there is an opportunity here from a media, from a journalism perspective, but also from a citizenry perspective, to mm-hmm. say that we do care about these places, that we're interested in them, that we want to hear, we want to see. And I think also when they are covered, that we respond to that, right? And mm-hmm. And certainly from a mass market perspective, nobody can respond to a crisis if they are not aware of it. And then even at an institutional perspective, if our policymakers aren't focused and don't understand what's happening in the Central African Republic or Zambia or Namibia, then also they're not called to act upon that. And so you can see in the U.S., for instance, where we have extraordinary policy making resourcing. It's in, for instance, the Ukraine or Gaza or other situations that are getting attention. And we all can only respond to what we know about and what we see.
Absolutely. And at least for the European continent, that media is very much oriented on what people want to see and read has always to do with the fact that they are losing a lot of their funding through advertisement. This changed completely in the last 5 or 10 years. And it's a sort of luxury nowadays that you do a media trip, a real-time media trip with journalists to one of the countries on the Forgotten Crisis list. We are doing that on an annual basis, and we can finance it because most of the media are not able to finance it. But we can do it thanks to a generous sponsor who enables us to do this trip. So this year, in the 10th edition, we have, I think, first time in 3 years that it's not forgotten crises are not exclusively located in sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, the number one, if we want to do a ranking, which is somehow heartbreaking in this context, but it makes it easier to understand the whole thing, is the Central African Republic. Number two, Namibia, and then Zambia. These are the most underreported crises of the year 2025. With more than 1 million people involved in the humanitarian crisis that we are talking about. There are clear parameters for everything. You find it on our websites and you find the full report also there. But this year we have Honduras and North Korea on the list, where more than 1 million of people are suffering a lot from not many care about it. Is there anything that still can surprise you in this whole debate, or is it for us crystal clear that we have to make choices, that funding decreases dramatically? We come to that point later. But how shall we deal with this list? What is it telling us in the end?
Well, I think especially over the last year, where we're seeing real constraints around governmental funding, certainly in the U.S. context, we've seen dramatic cuts in terms of humanitarian assistance. And we also are seeing an explicit connection between our national interest and our investments. And so that is a challenge when it comes to where is the greatest source of need, which does not always match to the geopolitical center of attention. And so I think it is really incumbent upon humanitarian organizations to make sure that we are lifting up these places, that they do not become, you know, literally invisible crisis, that people do not suffer and die with invisibility. And I do think that if we can bring to attention, we see this all the time when people see it, when they see a rapid onset natural disaster and there are cameras and you capture that, people respond. But when it is often this sort of ongoing latent set of crisis and challenges that perhaps are, you know, happening over a combination of years, it could be a combination of governance and conflict and drought and floods and natural disaster. Oftentimes it has all of those things happening, but over a longer period of time, the cameras don't catch it. We don't have the kind of, as you say, the extensive resourcing for media trips to or reporting from those places. And so I think that is why this kind of report is so important. And it's why I think this conversation is so critical.
I mean, you mentioned it yourself that we see a big shift in the institutional donor landscape, and the donor landscape of private donors and institutional donors. On first sight, it doesn't look that connected. But if you give it a second view, you see that there are also direct connections, because we see a clear tendency that also private donations and donations by corporates follow more or less the national debate. Isn't it like that? Because we seem to say, okay, this is one part, this is the other one. But over the years, and I would say more so in the last 5 years since COVID, there is a stronger connection between these groups and also the attention that is paid to things. Will you agree to that also from a US perspective?
Absolutely. And I think that is why it is so important to lift up these issues. We are having more private philanthropists ask us, where are the underreported crises? Where are the places where perhaps we may not be seeing these issues, but we want to try and invest there? So I think that's what we need to bring to people's attention. But we need to do it not only on an individual basis of donor by donor, but we need to, as this report does, make recommendations around what are the systems approaches that can help us address this at the base level, as well as the particular and specific level.
Now, this is absolutely key, because also a so-called forgotten crisis can become a major catastrophe with enormous impact on the region and also transcontinental. And this is very often forgotten, that neither migration nor political crisis, they don't come overnight. Very often, we had it in the last days, another earthquake in Afghanistan. And there you have the full range, very difficult, let's say it elegantly, political situation, a civil society that is totally left alone, forgotten and struggling for survival, women and girls in very very traumatic situation, no access to health services, no access to schooling, no access to education. This will have an impact on the coming generations. So I think that the dismantling and shutdown of USAID, somehow it was really a big surprise, wasn't it?
It was a big surprise. It was a big shock to, I think, our humanitarian system. As we know, the U.S. government had played a very significant and generous role in underwriting the broader humanitarian structure and systems globally, almost 40%. And so I think that, again, that was commensurate in many ways with the resources and power that are available to the U.S. So there are other donor nations that have even higher percentage of giving than the U.S. But it is a shock to the system as we move forward that I think we are still adjusting to and still needing to compensate. And I think there are real concerns. One of the countries in the list, as you mentioned, was Honduras. I had the chance to visit several times this year to Honduras, and you know, there are a growing set of challenges that will have a significant impact, for instance, back on the U.S. as it relates to either conflict or the erosion, for instance, of civil society, where we have, you know, the U.S. was investing significantly. You have almost a third of the economy dependent upon remittances. So all of that is bubbling up in a way that is clearly now manifest and seen in this report in terms of a crisis for the people that are living there, that potentially is going to exacerbate issues of migration, and also that potentially create a fragility that is dangerous for the future. So I think it's just really important that we pay attention to these crises, mm-hmm. and that we are trying to do what we can to both mitigate suffering, but also to mitigate the potential for them to become even greater and deeper and broader crisis, both regionally and also nationally.
Apart from the single humanitarian case that we look at. And this is something that is very often neglected in the discussion, that all this has a massive impact on the countries that we are working in, be it the US market, be it the European Union. Just hiding things or forgetting them or brushing them under an imaginary carpet does not necessarily mean that these things are not happening. And of course, decisions like decreasing funding for humanitarian aid is also sending messages out to the global community that we also should not underestimate, isn't it? USAID was funded in 1961 by a very popular, at least in Europe, popular president, by John F. Kennedy. And if I would say it in my own words, he invented USAID to help the positive image of the United States globally. And of course, it was one of the biggest contributors to international aid. But to put it into perspective and relation, it was 1% of the gross national product in average of a powerful, economically powerful country like the US. Also in Europe, we see many groups, not only right-wing groups, that really debate why should we invest into international aid. Isn't it much easier to put a big fence around Europe, which costs tons of money, to shut down for us at least the idea of these global problems, and we build our own nice European community and forget about international aid. So I think it is really key to see that these tendencies, we have it everywhere. And of course, we see ripple effects, right? vice versa, because the European Union will not be able to replace what USAID did. So we see really a dramatic change in the whole funding structure, which leads to also some unpleasant situations, not only for the people who have serious trouble now, but also for us as large organization and leaders, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you hearkened back to John Kennedy's creation of USAID. And John Kennedy was both an idealist and also a pragmatist. And so there is certainly a aspirational and I think humanitarian sensibility to the work of USAID. But he also talked about the national interest that we have in our interdependent world, and its economic security, its national security, its health security, all of those things. And if, you know, having just lived through a pandemic, we know that a fractional cost of health infrastructure investment that can ensure that we can contain a pandemic is a savings of trillions of dollars. It's no exaggeration to say when it comes to our global economy. And so, you know, I think we all have the opportunity now to make the case for, and perhaps more strongly than we have before, and maybe in simpler terms, to say, one is that we have a humanitarian both opportunity and obligation. I think many people believe that and resonate with that. Two is that we have our own interests in a world of security, economic and for people to be able to flourish in their own communities as it relates to everything from migration to health security. And also I think we need to remind people that we can solve big problems. I mean, we've seen poverty go down dramatically over the last decades. We've seen maternal mortality. We've seen childhood mortality. I think sometimes because we focus on the crisis, we don't give enough credence to the fact that when we respond to a crisis, we save lives. And when we invest in development context, we actually prevent emergency crisis. And so I just think we have our work cut out for us to remind people of all those realities, both in the US and in Europe, you know.
Absolutely. This is very true for all of us. And we also have, we can highlight here that there is a calculation that demonstrates that if you invest in development, so-called development projects before emergency hits, it is seven times less investment necessary. I don't want to say it's seven times cheaper, but you need only a portion of the funding that you need when a big emergency hits. And this is something that CARE stands for. We are always there. And I think the argument, and we have seen, both of us have seen it many times ourselves, it is never enough. No matter how the situation is and how generous the funding is, it is never enough. And now it is even more dramatic because we see a complete, it's even called the reset of the humanitarian system, because the worldwide availability goes down to 40 to 50% of what was available 1 or 2 years ago, plus that the number of severe emergencies is unfortunately increasing. So more than 300 million people are in dire need of humanitarian aid, tendency growing. And this is something that should not frighten people off, neither us in our functions nor the donors. But you should really, we should all remind us, okay, we never could help everybody. This was also not the case in the past. But those who can be saved and who can be helped and who can get back on their feet again, we should focus on those. And we should imagine it's people like the two of us, people like you and me, and people like our donors. And then you don't have so many arguments anymore to say, ah, it doesn't make sense. Let's forget about all that and let's keep all the funding for ourselves. Because in the end, many of the problems are global. I mean, also environmental issues are global, also female rights are a global issue, economic economic problems can't be solved by one or two countries alone. So I think it is also an ask for rethink global collaboration and also the good sides of it, not only the negative sides, because there is good and bad in everything. And we should really focus on the positive sides of collaboration, right?
Absolutely. And I think we don't want people to give up on, oh, well, there's been this enormous pullback on resources. You know, we're helpless or we're paralyzed. No, we have to actually just figure out how do we rebuild our constituency? How do we ensure that we are even increasing our capacity for the fact that the resources that are invested get to the places where they are needed the most? And that's, you know, as we think about this report, that's exactly what we're saying is that we can take these resources. We know that, for instance, there are some humanitarian crises that get more attention than others. They typically do have a higher threshold of the goal that is accomplished. So many, if you think about these countries, Namibia and Malawi and certainly Central African Republic, they are only getting, you know, less than, in some instances, 15% of what is required. So if we can be more proportional to how we are investing our resources, we can do the greatest good. And you know, that is what we're all called to do is how do we take this moment and respond to it with the kind of energy and focus and clarity that will both save the most lives and also, I think, rebuild a healthy and flourishing global system of our interdependence.
Which is absolutely key. And I want to close this conversation. I hear very often a buzzword when I talk to my, not only my US colleagues, but I attended an interesting digital global summit last week in Amsterdam, and nearly everybody said, let's do more with less. And after these 3 days, I couldn't hear it any longer, to be honest, because I simply can't imagine how we will do more with less. I would say let's do the best feasible with less, and let's ask the constituency, let's ask the civil society, and let's ask the institutional donors to do it together. Because let's do more with less is a buzzword, and it shows to me a bit of the despair that is in the sector, because this is not very realistic. Let's do what we can all together. Let's join forces and let's benefit from collaboration, global collaboration, and then we can rebuild a flourishing system for as many people as possible, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I do think we have to lean into collaboration, lean into new forms of networks, lean into new technologies, lean into, as you are doing so effectively at Care Austria. And we certainly will always continue to build sort of the highest return on investment that we possibly can manage. And I think we will not give up on rebuilding the constituency and resourcing for the people around the world who need it the most, because as we recognize that there is caring everywhere in the world, and we will stand with those who are caring, and we will do our best to both support and you know, be in solidarity with them.
Absolutely. This was a wonderful closing comment. Dear listeners, I hope you enjoyed our conversation, and I hope that you will lean in with CARE and the fabulous work that CARE is doing globally, and that you don't have this so often quoted donor fatigue and think it doesn't make a lot of sense. I hope that Michelle and I, we could convince you how much sense it makes. We rely on you. You can rely on us. And for sure, we can talk to each other in a week's time. Thanks for joining us, and thanks, Michelle.
Thank you so much, Andrea.
Thank you for listening. This was CARE in Action, the podcast by CARE Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For more information about CARE and our projects, visit care.at. There, you'll also find out how you can support our work. This podcast is made possible with the generous support of CC Real. Thank you for your commitment, which enables this series of conversations. See you next time.